Next presenter is Nicholas Greco, Assistant Professor of Communications and Media at Providence University College. His research topics include the singing voice and enigmatic celebrity.
It's got a much loftier name probably than what it is.
It's a good name.
But we want loftiness right at the start.
We want. And the title, your paper title is also lofty.
It is, isn't it?
Of Desperation and Desire in the Killer's Battle Born.
If anything, I'm good at lofty titles. I've written notes on my paper here, so if I end up starting to speak about what Dana spoke about directly, it's because I'm starting to read the things I was writing down when Dana was speaking. This is a work of phenomenology, sort of, except that I'm depending on others and their observations to figure out what's going on. In any case, this paper will explore transience, desire, desperation, and labor in the songs of the Killer's Battle Born. It will take into account theoretical notions of desire and transience in order to demonstrate how the album encapsulates these notions, creating a vivid picture and a desperate moment in time. Reading this after a few weeks actually seems quite lofty, so we'll see if I actually live up to those very lofty ideas. The celebrated Las Vegas band The Killers released their fourth studio album in 2012 called Battle Born. The band has also released three music videos in association with the album. Now, not all of the reviews seem to exactly legitimize the band's output. While reviewers of the songs and videos are mostly positive in their assessment, they're not always entirely serious, and I'll give you an example of what I mean here. Jason Lipschitz, writing for Billboard, encourages the fans to let your fists punch the cold night air, rock fans. This one's for you. And writing for Rolling Stone, John Dolan describes Brandon Flowers' singing with the following: singer Brandon Flowers' unmistakable commitment to unmistakable commitment. Kind of cool, kind of ridiculous, and Vegas all the way. So I thought at the start that I would just play you 15 or 20 seconds of their video Runaways, and hopefully this will all work. And for the sake of William Eckert, I'll stop it there. Runaways, though, recounts the experiences of requited teenage love, which blossoms to engagement because of pregnancy. Unfortunately, the male narrator of the song seems to have some trouble with the arrangement. He sings, "But I got the tendency to slip when the nights get wild." Now married, the protagonist seems unsettled, pining for their happy past together. Nevertheless, the protagonist ends the song with the resolution that he will not let her go, since, after all, we are all just runaways. What is particularly interesting for this present study is the nature of the lyrics. Flowers creates descriptive verses, at least in my mind, that seem to carry the song along a loose narrative. He writes of blonde hair blowing in the summer wind, a blue-eyed girl playing in the sand, and of their time later, at night I come home after they, that is the protagonist's wife and child, go to sleep, like a stumbling ghost I haunt these halls, there's a picture of us on our wedding day. These are vivid images that both involve and evoke photographs. And so I question here, can the various vivid images that are captured in the lyrics of Runaways be likened to photographs, mediated slices of a sort of reality, arresting an image and enticing the viewer to discover the greater narrative? If so, do they contain what Roland Barthes calls an air, the notion of the soul, the shadow that makes an image true? Then this is the locus of listener's desire, perhaps. What keeps the listener listening, and what makes for that listener the songs true? I have to refer to Roland Barthes' novelistic study of photography as a cultural process that was published in 1980, and I enjoyed our discussion even so briefly about post-structuralism and so forth here. I have a soft spot for structuralism, it seems, but I'm happily post-structuralist. I'm not happy anything, really. But
anything.
In any case, Roland Barthes writes, he wishes to enter the paper's depth when he looks at a photograph, a desire to see something more than simply the image that is presented. He refers to notions of desire here. I can have the fond hope of discovering truth, is what Barthes says, although he admits that he won't find it. He suggests that sometimes he perceives something of the truth in a photograph, what he calls a likeness, but the likeness is imprecise or imaginary, and he concludes, I cannot penetrate, I cannot reach into the photograph. The photograph is unlike the text. That is, our vision of it is certain, according to Barthes, a curious thing for a semiologist to suggest. The photograph arrests interpretation. He says that a photograph is this has been. Barthes' frustration is evident here. He still seeks, or more properly, he desires something more in the photograph. He wishes to discover the person in the photograph completely. It seems here that Barthes is grasping at straws, so to speak. He wants to find truth in a photograph, and so he finds, as the locus of his desire, the air. But then he immediately writes, the air of the face is unanalyzable, but it evokes for the observer little individual soul, the good in one person, the bad in another. These are some of Barthes' words. I'm mixing mine and his together. It's rather poetic, I think. The air is what allows Barthes to identify his mother in this photograph that's famous, if any of you know the work, the Winter Garden photograph, and I'll speak about it in a moment. For Barthes, this is the culmination of his desperate search through photographs, something that began as a phenomenological study of why photographs, these slices of reality, these papers are imbued with such memory and power, why these things were so effective, and what draws people to view and keep them. And you'll remember in the back of your mind, I'm suggesting that the lyrics in The Killers evokes photography. But partly the study emerged from the mourning that Barthes was experiencing due to the death of his mother in 1978, and Brian Dillon writes about this in the following way. Having lost his mother, with whom he had lived most of his life, he goes looking for her among old photographs. Time and again, the face he finds is not quite hers, even if objectively she looks like herself. At last, he discovers her true likeness, the air that he remembers, in a picture of Henriette, aged 5, taken in a winter garden in 1898. In the journal entry that recounts this discovery, Barthes simply notes, je pleure, or I cry. And Roland Barthes explains it as follows, and I quote from him, all the photographs of my mother which I was looking through were a little like so many masks. At last, suddenly the mask vanished. There remained a soul, ageless but not timeless, since this air was the person I used to see, consubstantial with her face, each day of her long life. This is what makes a true photograph, the capturing of the air, one's soul or one's shadow, to use some of Barthes' terminology. But then consider Flowers, Brandon Flowers from The Killers, his words to the song Here With Me, in which he sings something that maybe makes us laugh. I don't want your picture on my cell phone. I want you here with me. In this instance, the cell phone, as a carrier of images, does not allow the transmission of the air of the subject of the photograph. The narrator desires to have the person with them, physically present rather than present in the photograph. If one can think of the narrative and descriptive moments in the songs as photographs, can one think of the songs as fleeting and transient as well? And so I move on to my second subject here, Paul Virilio, who speaks of a kind of desperation in the transience of modern global society. Is such transience also depicted in the spatial aspects of the music, such as on the track Battle Born? And I should mention here that even in this track, Runaways, we didn't really see it much, but there are highways and lots of moving and stuff, and this was one of the first ideas that I had when I saw this, if there was something to do with speed and movement. And so Virilio is the first person sort of to go to if you want to look at that sort of thing, at least in my mind. So now I'd like to play a couple of minutes of the song Battleborn. I don't have fancy graphics or anything. It's gonna take more than Well, writers at Billboard describe the song this way. Rather than descend back towards Earth on the album's final song, the Killers come out guns blazing on Battleborn's finale. That's from Billboard. The song begins with a single guitar playing over some soft strings until the full band joins in, until succumbing to a more sparse accompaniment once Flowers begins singing the first verse. With the chorus, the guitars rise in volume and the listener hears the first instance of strong background vocals, which we've heard in this clip here. It evokes Queen, perhaps, in their choir-like backing vocals. And these vocals contribute to an increasing intensity as the song develops to a sort of climax during which Flowers and the backing vocals alternate their delivery in a sort of two-pronged attack that not only builds intensity, but also contributes to a sense of greater oral space, and hopefully this was clear in this clip. This might be why the writers at Billboard use the following phrase to describe the album's sounds. Battleborn contains songs that come close to stadium size, stadium ready, aspiring anthem, that is, songs that are aspiring to be anthemic, and songs rooted in 80s arena riffage. All of these references to large spaces. What is particularly compelling here is not only the description of oral space that the writers describe, but also the memory or nostalgia that is evoked in these sorts of phrases. The Killers and its lead singer Flowers cannot stand on their or his own, but instead must be situated among other artists, be it Queen, Bruce Springsteen, or U2. So just as photographs point directly to their reference, so the Killers point to those bands that precede them. In a way, like photography, the Killers keep their reference alive. And so I must turn to Walter Benjamin, who writes about photography, and I quote, "No matter how artful the photographer, no matter how carefully posed his subject, the beholder feels an irresistible urge to search a picture for the tiny spark of contingency of the here and now, with which reality has, so to speak, seared the subject, to find the inconspicuous spot where in the immediacy of that long-forgotten moment the future subsists so eloquently that we, looking back, may rediscover it." Roland Barthes says a photograph shows us what has been, and Benjamin says, no, it gives us what is here and now. As Steve Edwards explains in his brief history of photography, memory is, after all, a trace or impression of the past that takes place in the present. So one must also consider Brandon Flowers' singing voice in this discussion. Flowers employs a very quick vibrato, which evokes the feeling that he's pushing his voice. His intonation is often slightly sharp, a consequence often blamed on tension in the singing voice. Both tension and the notion of pushing the voice both connote desperation, or the manic working out of some issue. Desperation is often manifest in a kind of labor, in getting worked up, if you will. Both Bart and Virilio hint at this, in that desire demands a certain amount of work, in expressing, of searching and consuming, of effort in moving from one place to another, to escape congestion, to long for another place, or perhaps the next place. Consider the depiction of airfields and road vehicles in the song The Way It Was, and the transience and soft relationships of new communications technologies in Here With Me, with those images on the cell phone rather than personal intimacy. And I'll just quickly talk about Virilio in his book, The Futurism of the Instant, Stop Eject. He approaches the subject of future environmental migrants, those displaced by conflict as well as by development projects. If earlier eras were about sustainable staying put, this new era will be one of habitable circulation, something that a term he uses, which calls into question notions of citizenship and nationhood. He calls the resulting upheavals the portable revolution, which, along with revolutions in transportation and transmission technologies, will lead to what he calls an interactive planisphere. I understand I'm giving you, like, if you want to take notes, you don't have to read the book anymore. I'm just giving you everything that's in it. Throughout the work, Virilio moves from the smaller scale, for instance, discussing the loading dock or the train station, to the larger scale, the city as a whole, or the whole world in movement, suggesting that these spaces of movement are ultimately ungovernable, at least in terms of conventional legal governance. Throughout the book, though, Virilio explores the idea of speed in the early 21st century and its results. His text, in fact, is formatted for speed. He mentions issues and leaves them, moving on to a new issue with a new paragraph. And this is not unlike the fragmentary nature of song lyrics, or even perhaps the way that Flowers presents his singing voice. His book is an uncompromising look at the power of what he calls Révolution de l'Empereur, or what translator Julie Rose has deemed the portable revolution, a movement enacted because of the increase in the payload capacity, or capacité d'Empereur, of the 21st century in terms of transportation and communications technology. If space is problematized in the 21st century due to progress in terms of communication and transportation technologies, so is time, as Virilio argues in the third section of the book, and please bear with me for another moment. The futurism of the instant, what he calls the balance of computerized terror, leads to a loss of memory, a loss of the past, but also a loss of the future. And so Virilio argues, thinking back to what Bart and Benjamin talk about, the result is an experience of a kind of perpetual instant. What Virilio sees as a blight, he also sees as a solution. In order to solve problems such as the erasure of space and time and the chronic consumption of the earth by its occupants, he suggests that we become nomads to counteract the sedentary characteristics of the ultra-city. Now, he talks about rootedness and says that in its constant communication and transportation flows of the ultra-city, if you will, one can find, in a way, rootedness. And this is where I come back to the killers, and I end very unsatisfactorily with this. The killers are fundamentally, then, a band without roots, drawing musically from the 1980s, informed by the 2000s, inspired by English and Irish bands, and situated in the Western United States. Their unrootedness, their superficiality as recognized by reviewers, is manifest in their desperation as they exist as a sort of photograph of the perpetual instant. Thank you.
Time for questions. A very rich paper. Take a second to think about your questions. We have time for that too. Yeah.
Well, I have a question. Coming from Denmark, we also listen to Kill on the radio.
Yeah.
And but what the experience is that even though people understand English, they tend to not hear lyrics. So I was just wondering, well, there's a famous Swedish study of all the singers who ever recorded, all the Swedish singers who ever recorded Elvis's Hound Dog. He asked one of them to ask them if they knew what a hound dog was.
Yeah.
The singers knew what a hound dog was,
yeah,
but it sounded like rock and roll, so they liked it.
Yeah.
But I was wondering, is there a connection here? Because when I hear Brendan Clouds, I just hear, as you say, I hear the sound of Springsteen, I hear the sound of U2, I hear the sound of Queen.
Sure.
I don't actually know what he's
saying. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, certainly the voice is the first thing that we hear, the voice itself, rather than even what it's communicating. And so I guess what I've been trying to do is to figure out then what that voice means, right? I mean, that's sort of the phenomenological sort of project here. And so it's interesting. I mean, we don't always know what stuff means. What I find interesting is amongst my students, when I ask them questions like, what's your favorite music? A lot of them will somehow revert back and say, well, it's because of the words. And I don't know why that is, because it wasn't like that for me when I was younger. And probably for many of us, that wasn't the experience. But a lot of my students say, well, it's the words that I like. And it's like, that's just silly. So there are, I mean, well, I just say, you know, let's talk about the music and figure out, because there is something there too. So that's why I tried to get into a little bit about the music, even though I was very cursory and perhaps unsatisfactorily looking at that sort of thing. But certainly within Flowers himself, there are all of these things. The past is certainly burned on him. That's not the right way of saying it. But.
So, great paper, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's an ambiguity that I hear in the Killers' music,
sure,
and in perhaps everything that, well, I don't know everything that Brandon Flowers does, but there's an ambiguity in the music, and there's an ambiguity in that you talk about as well, that I'm wondering if you just want to get into a little bit more or try to clarify or comment on.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, you mentioned that Brandon Flowers cites Queen and Springsteen as influences, and these seem like kind of authentic and not put on musical personas. Whereas Brandon Flowers seems very playful, ironic, almost campy in, you know, calling his band The Killers, and then having these kind of stadium rock songs. Yeah. I think their second album, they had these mustaches and plaid shirts that was kind
of... sort of Western. And,
Right. So there's this ambiguity, you know, between the real desperation and the irony, I guess. Mm-hmm. You quote the word desire in the title of your paper, and there's the real urge then for something, or the desire to be believed, the desire to desperately then be believed. So I just hear a lot of this ambiguity here. It's kind of a dual-sidedness, I guess, in the music and that you bring up. And I'm just wondering if you want to get into that anymore or what you make of it.
I think you've correctly sort of, you've noticed things that I wasn't necessarily explicit with in the paper. Hmm. I mean, it seems that the reviewers and the critics see the influences. I don't know how much Flowers has said about, you know, Queen being an influence on him necessarily. The reviewers point these things out. Flowers has pointed to people like Morrissey and others as being sort of direct influences. And so perhaps the ambiguity, and I mean, I know a bit of Morrissey's work, so the ambiguity might come from that relationship there. The Killers, I think, are an interesting subject, Flowers perhaps, because of their ambiguity, and this is part of the threads that I enjoy sort of going down, is why is it that we like them even though they're completely ambiguous? You're right that they are not the most authentic band in the world.
And that seems to be
the point. Whatever authenticity means.
Right.
Like, I'm not trying to open that debate necessarily. But I think that's their project, to be playful.
Right.
But I think that the reason why I wrote this paper, or why I started on this, was because I wanted to know why I was listening to The Killers. So it becomes this phenomenological project. Why do I listen to them? And why does William Eckert hate them? That's the second part.
I hadn't quite learned to like them yet.
Oh, I hadn't quite. Oh, very good. That's more. But that'll be chapter two.
When the scales fall from my eyes. And all that.
Well, that'll be chapter three. How to convince William Eckert to. Yeah. So those are great points.
Well, I loved your phrase "spaces of movement" because it seems to encapsulate that ambiguity quite a bit.
Yeah, you know, they're not the only band to do this. Sort of be ambiguous in that. I've argued in the past that U2 does something similar, even though many people have all kinds of opinions of how U2 presents itself. But I've often talked about U2 as being a band that doesn't fit geographically. And we talk about them as Irish, but they're not really Irish at all. And anyway, that's a different paper, so we'll leave that for another conference.
Okay, well, since I've been name checked, I did have one question.
Sorry,
no, it's cool. And this actually relates to that in the sense of, I mean, this is maybe really informed by my own, you know, I don't naturally gravitate to this because I have so many preconceptions about rock music.
Sure.
I mean, I've been shaped by a whole other kind of thing.
Sure.
But one thing that struck me was, I think that the way you used speed was totally appropriate. But then there's another maybe ambiguity in that that you could really pick apart, which is the one reason that I personally, you know, I don't relate to this music so much is because of the rhythmic profile and the sonic profile. It's not speedy. I mean, to me, it comes off as turgid, which is, I choose the negative word just because that's my gut feeling about it. And, you know, I was raised on Pepe and, you know, pogoing and stuff like that. So that's always been a very obvious characteristic of not just this, but an awful lot of newer rock, you know, avoiding peppiness and, you know, the music that traditionally, well, not traditionally, but, you know, 20 years ago would have been considered fast and speedy. But I think you're right. There probably is some other kind of speed happening here. So I'm wondering if you want to talk about that. Is it another ambiguity? What's the relationship between the fact that it isn't literally speedy music in the narrow formalist sense, but there's another kind of speed there?
This won't be a satisfactory answer, I don't think. But
it was a lousy question.
Yeah. It is music that does not move very quickly, but the voice propels it along. And I think that's...
So there's a propulsiveness to it. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And I think that's the speed that I'm... It's as if... I'm not answering this well. It's as if his voice wants to go faster.
Right. Well, you know what occurred to me was, like, that links a little bit to Bart. I mean, I was thinking also of Deleuze and the notion of the concept at infinite speed, which is also a point. which is also a nicely non-reductive formalist, right, you know, is like quantum almost. But it's sort of similar to things you said about the photograph and, you know, the air, and that moment is, in one sense, there's a kind of an infinite speed, but it's contained in this singular, detemporalized moment. And maybe there's a link to make there with what you just said about the urgency of the voice as a kind of an intensive speed.
Right. You know, so. Thank you.
Great. Well, thank you. We have one more paper.